This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Helen Farmer with you, and my goodness, a bit of an all-star cast today. So many experts across a huge range of subjects. Let's start with change. Coach, consultant, trainer Rania Leng with us as we talked about why some people respond to change in different ways, some of the common challenges that come up for expat families here in the UAE, and ultimately things you can have in your toolkit to help you move forward. We were also addressing gym intimidation. Is this something you have felt anxiety about getting into the gym, going to a class? We were speaking to one woman who has overcome hers with spectacular results. Discussing space tech, how could looking to the skies help prevent natural disasters here on Earth? We had an actual rocket scientist explaining it, and exploring the concept of déjà vu. Could it point to something more sinister? Plus, Hamza Zawali on hand. We love helping you out on the money front. And he was discussing salary negotiations, how to get what you're worth. Jim Rohn says, your life does not get better by chance. It gets better by change. But what if you don't want that change? We are bringing in this afternoon Rania Leng. She is a coach, a trainer, a consultant. Talk about change and how we ultimately can feel about it, react to it, roll with it. And we're talking about families and kids as well today. So if this is something that you're coming up against in your family dynamic, changing circumstances, we can absolutely help. You can be anonymous on the text line 4001, ARN Play app. And of course, the WhatsApp too. Pick up the phone and give us a call. Rania, thank you for being with us today. I'm really curious about why you're curious about change. And what do you think people tuning into Dubai Eye between now and 5 o'clock will learn from our chat around change today?
Well, hopefully, what I would like to bring my intentions is really around bringing peace with change and having the confidence to face uncertainty and the unknown. Knowing that ultimately everything's going to be okay.
Isn't that exactly it, though, that peace of mind? Because sometimes change, sometimes it comes in quite a negative way. Sometimes it can be a change that is not what you'd choose. It could be, you know, a loss or a job loss, a change of circumstances, and you're forced to change. Your hand is forced. And sometimes it could be something really positive that you're going towards and you want to make a change. And I find it really fascinating about why and how people feel about change, how we respond and react. And what does the research say about, like, maybe it's personality types and our relationship with change? What does your research and your work suggest?
Well, it's very much, it is personality types. And it's a lot of it is how we process, how we think about things, how we process thoughts, feelings, how we take action. Mm-hmm. Even though we may have planned change, something positive, we may still have mixed emotions.
Yeah, still around might struggle with it.
And it's often the case that people think because they want something that they would be really excited about it all the time. Mm-hmm. And that's really unrealistic because we can have opposing emotions about something that we've planned.
Absolutely. Two things can be true at the same time. Yeah, you can be desperate to have a baby. Yeah. And then when that happens, you can be absolutely terrified.
Yeah.
You know, you can. Or, you know, moving countries, for example. You know, amazing opportunity could come up and you could be like, we've really worked towards this and it's amazing, you know, job offer and we're so excited. But, oh my gosh, I'm grieving, you know, my loss of friendships or my routine and things like that. So it's quite a conflicting time when there's big change as well.
Yeah.
How can I ask you a personal question? How are you about change? Because obviously you've got a huge amount of, I guess, context and, you know, information around it. But, you know, with your personality type, how do you react to changes?
Well, my personality type, I'm being a coach, so I'm very much, I help clients a lot with change and organisational change when I'm working with corporate clients. So I've got a personality type that goes towards goals. I like to achieve goals, so milestones, goals. So for me, it's once I've identified the positive goal that I want, I start moving forward. And I tend to use that as my, when I dip emotionally, I go, okay, let me remind myself of the positives that are coming out of this situation.
That's interesting.
But we're all completely different. I mean, one of the things that we do know from neuroscience is every single brain is as unique as a fingerprint. And we process things completely different. So, which is really important with families, because with parents, often they want to lead their children in a way how they think and how they feel. And they may not really appreciate that the child is processing things in different ways, and siblings will process things in different ways.
And there's no right or wrong as such.
Exactly.
Even though, let's be honest, sometimes we feel like other people's reactions or timelines are incorrect because it doesn't align with ours. I was listening to a podcast the other day, and it was talking about something called the hero's journey. Are you familiar with the hero's journey? It's Joseph Campbell. And it was talking about how so many books, you know, films, I'm just trying to think of an example, Star Wars or Harry Potter, for example. You know, you've got your hero. It starts off in this kind of quite ordinary, you know, he's living in the cupboard under the stairs, and then a change comes in. And for him, you know, it's a letter, but it could be, you know, the message for Han Solo. It could be, you know, whatever it might be in some of these classic stories. And change is sometimes forced upon someone, or they go towards change. And then you have this time where it's about, well, this midpoint of how am I going to react to that? What am I going to do with it? How, you know, what's going to propel me? And the main thing I took away from this was there are going to be changes that you want. There's changes that you don't want. There's going to be hardships. But as you say, you can't give up. You can't turn around. You can't do the U-turn during the midpoint, because that's not necessarily going to get you to where you want to be. And ultimately, that's not going to get you to the point where, as you said so kind of eloquently, things are okay. When you're working with families in particular, Rania, what are some of the common challenges that are coming up in the UAE for families? Some of the changes that people might be really struggling to deal with, to recalibrate?
I think the biggest challenge is when the different family members want different things. And it's very difficult to then know what's right for the family, because you have, you know, it's always that, do we stay as expats? The big decision, do we stay? Do we go?
When?
Do we go return back to our home country? Do we try, and usually it's job related, do we stay expats and move on to another country? Mm-hmm. So when there's a disconnect with the parents, that's very difficult, because everyone, you know, you're processing your own emotions, and sometimes, you know, I always call it timelines. Different partners will have different timelines on what they want out of the situation. Depending on whose job it is, there may be an imbalance of decision making on, you know, and the feeling of not being in control of the decision that's made. That's very difficult.
Some really interesting messages coming in. It is a real time of flux. I think a lot of people making decisions about, should we stay or should we go? And Sakena's on the line with that dilemma. How are you, Sakena?
I'm good. Thank you for having me on air, Rania and Helen.
My absolute pleasure. We're talking about change, and I guess you're asking us to help you with a decision. Would you mind telling us a little bit about what you're weighing up right now?
Yeah, so my husband has recently taken up, but he was promoted, and he has to move countries. Another thing is, we do have a golden visa here. So we have an option that my son and I can stay back here, and he would be visiting Dubai like almost every other week. So, and he has been traveling a lot anyway, so we are used to, you know, living on our own. So we were like wondering whether we should shift, because it's, you know, my son is in year 9 now, and he's going to go to year 10 next year, which is a crucial year.
It is.
Both my husband and I have also shifted schools during crucial year. So we don't. So my husband is like, it's not the end of the world. He's resilient. He will manage. But, you know, I have a life too.
I wish I could say, this is what you should do, and we can just wave the magic wand and make the decision. And
And there's no place like Dubai, is
there? There's no place. But I wondered if, Ron, you could maybe offer up some. We're talking about change today, but I think how you come to a decision is a really, really pertinent point at this time. We can talk, specifically about Cicada, but for everyone listening today, weighing up your options and doing what you can with the information you have at hand, Rania, what do you tend to suggest?
Hi, Cicada. So one of the things that I would advise is, if you haven't already, sit down with your husband and your child and go through what's important for you each about this potential change. And if each of you do a list, what you can do is actually review, the value that you each have and the different perspectives that you each have about how it's going to affect you individually. And that can help really support discussions around how you can model your next chapter that involves taking each other's viewpoints and considerations and feelings mm-hmm. in that process.
So kind of, if I can offer a less logical take on this. When I was 23, I got the option to move to Bahrain with my parents. And it was a choice basically between moving abroad and moving to London. And what I did is I had no idea how to make this decision. And I was told a couple of things. One was flip a coin and, assign a certain decision to each side of the coin. And when it flips, and if you look at your gut reaction, if you're instantly disappointed by what you're seeing on that coin, you've got your answer. What I ended up doing, though, is going out with two sets of friends on two kind of consecutive nights. And I told one group that I was moving to Bahrain and this is what life was going to look like. And this is how we would stay in touch. And this is what I'd be doing for work, hopefully. And, all that kind of logistical stuff. And I kind of embodied that decision. And then the next night I went out and I said, there's been this opportunity to move, but I've decided to stay here. And I might think about maybe doing this job or, da, da, da. And really kind of living out those decisions, role-playing, and even though my friends didn't know that that's what we were doing, was so, so fascinating. Spoiler alert, I obviously moved because I've been in the Middle East now for 18 years. But I think Rania's point's really, really interesting to explore it really, really fully with everyone who's got skin in the game and understand what your values are as a family, to hear your boys, questions and concerns. We can't tell you what decision to make, obviously, but will you let us know what decision you come to?
Definitely.
Thank you so, so much. And if you need some help with change, get the pen and paper out. Good luck.
I will definitely get in touch with you.
Good luck with whatever you decide. But as I said,
thank you.
Rania, fantastic for dealing with change, whether that is your husband moving away or indeed you deciding to take the plunge. We are talking change on the show today. Lots of questions coming in on this. I think a lot of people feeling in flux. We've had a message here asking about feeling confused after a work colleague has left, and also how to help a child who might struggle with change too. If you've got any questions, you're more than welcome to get in touch. Rania Lang is with us today. She's a coach, a trainer, consultant, and we're talking about change. Maya Angelou said, if you don't like something, change it. If you can't change it, change your attitude. The reason I wanted to talk about this today is actually you popped up on my social media, Rania, and it was somebody asking about change in their child. And if my memory serves, she'd said, we're changing nannies, our nanny is leaving, and we don't know how to explain it to our little boy. We don't know how to help him process it. And I wondered if maybe you could offer up some practical tips for parents, how to involve their children in age-appropriate decisions and how we can support our children at times of change, whether it is, mum going back to work, a nanny moving on, moving house. I mean, my goodness, the flux of change for so many families over this last week. What can be really helpful to have in our parental toolkit?
I think the most important attitude to have would be to be transparent about our emotions as parents when we're talking to our children. And while we may feel that there's a lot of pressure to be the superhero and to know all the certainties around a changing situation, often we don't. And realistically, it's much easier to relieve ourselves, easier said than done, remove the pressure off ourselves to be that, the superhero in the situation. Because it's actually, it's a good skill for our children to learn how to deal with change.
And it's good for them to see that we're fallible and to hear us sometimes saying, I don't know.
Absolutely.
There is a great argument, of course, for being, you know, their port in the storm and, you know, that place of safety and security. And I think that is crucial. But we don't always have the answers. I wish we did.
Exactly.
You know, with what listeners messaging in now saying, you know, I need your help making a decision or I don't know how to navigate this. Why is that so important, that transparency, Rania?
Well, I think that there is security in being allowed to experience emotions and having help labelling what they are and understanding that emotions change. They're not something that is factual, although we may react to them as if they are at a particular time. So as there's stress, usually it's natural human nature to get a bit snappy and a bit impatient. And we all do that. So being able to talk with our children, there's actually a lot of psychological research in when a child doesn't understand a situation and there's an emotional disconnect, explaining it rationally afterwards so that the child can reflectively review their emotions, how they felt, and have the reconnection and reconfirmation from the parent that this was something that was happening because of.
Yes.
And then the affirmation of love, security, things are going to be okay, there's going to be a positive outcome, but we might not know what that is.
Yeah.
But that's really important. And it actually does help situations a lot when we are snappy and impatient and stressed and to explain why. So one of the things that I often...
Mummy's having a really hard time right now. But this was me the other day. I had a bit of a, I don't want to say breakdown because that sounds very dramatic, but I had a minor breakdown and had a bit of a cry and explained to the kids, you know, I'm dealing with this. I'm dealing with that. Mummy's sad because of this. And I mean, my kids are 7 and 9. They have got a bit of an understanding more than, you know, a 4-year-old or a 2-year-old. But I think it was really valuable for them to see me as a human, for them to go, Mummy's sad because of her friend and she's stressed about this and, you know, da-da-da-da-da. And maybe give a bit of context to why I have been, as you say, a little bit snappy and irritable, and why last night I was like, would you just go to bed? I've had enough. Stop doing handstands and getting dirty feet all over the walls. Just go to bed. I've had enough.
I think a lot of the time there's, so what I call it task loading, which is comes from emergency first response and dive training. But when we are task loaded and we don't have enough time to get through our task load, which is a lot of the time, mental task load is often on the mum and drives a lot of our stress. So whether it's battling with increase in traffic, whether it's, you know, trying to take care of so much in a very small amount of time or not having a chance to process things ourselves, it gets very stressful. Mm-hmm. And being able to, so that was something that I actually taught my daughter from when she could talk. So one of the things I would do when I was not so stressed would say, okay, can you do this for me? Can you do this for me? Can you do this for me? And then she'll be like getting stressed. And I'll be like, sometimes this is what you do to me.
Yeah.
And sometimes I behave in a way that I'm not happy with. And that makes me sad because I'm making you sad. Mm-hmm. And I explain it.
Yeah. And I think it's that repair, isn't it? Mm. You know, if you do explode, which we all do, you know, we do say something maybe we don't mean, and that can be to a kid or to a partner or, you know, a colleague, going back and in a calmer moment and explaining and repairing is really, really crucial. I've got so many questions I want to get to, Rania. Right, let's go to the text line. If you do have any messages, 4001. A message here, and you can, you know, leave your name off, makes no odds, saying, I'm at a real loss of what to do and I'm hoping for some advice. Our son is 10 and struggles with his emotions, highly sensitive and hates change. We need to start looking at secondary schools, and he's so resistant to this. We did one tour and he lost it, getting really frustrating, to be honest. So big change, and one that a lot of children will be facing if their schools don't go all the way through to 18, you know, changing secondary, which is a big deal, especially in this case, if there's, you know, more things at play in terms of personality type. What would you advise, and what can be really useful, Rania?
Well, often explosive behaviour is a sign of fear. And when it comes to us as individuals, like I said earlier, we're very unique in how we process things. Without understanding too much information about the how he lost it, it's a case of really exploring, enabling him and allowing him to explore his feelings around what was it specifically that was the trigger for the reaction. Mm-hmm. And whether, usually with fear, there's a lot of unknowns. And when there's a lot of unknowns, we can remedy that by doing a little bit more research or more visits to different schools.
Their website or speak to parents or kids who are there.
Exactly.
So fill in the blanks, because in the blanks, that's where we start to kind of spiral and catastrophize. And
yes. And our imagination is amazing.
Yeah. In good and good and bad ways.
Exactly. And it's the same. And that's one of the things that children find fascinating when I'm coaching them, is that your imagination is absolutely incredible. Mm-hmm. And it does great things for you. And sometimes it can imagine other things that are also really dramatic. Mm-hmm. So it's understanding that they're in control of that imagination, and they can imagine, they can choose what they imagine in a situation. And having that based then on more research and more, like you said, filling in the blanks, really does help them have a more realistic view of what the future could be.
I really hope that helps. But I don't think you're alone, because I think a lot of parents feel anxious about that situation as well. And I'm sure an awful lot of kids pick up on our own anxiety around big changes as well. Rania is with us today. Up next, we're going to explore the concept of different until it is normal. How can it be used to help children in particular understand and accept new situations? Also had a message from what I presume is a grown-up saying a work colleague has left after 12 years and really, really sad about it. Mourning. So what role does grief have when it comes to dealing with change? Coach, trainer and consultant Rania Lang is with us today as we explore. It's really fascinating the things that people are getting in touch about, Rania. We've had a couple of messages about moving house and kind of navigating that. We've also had a question here about a work colleague leaving after 12 years and feeling really sad, to the point where I'm questioning why it's making me so sad. It's making me want to leave. We've shared so many laughs. The team isn't the same. I feel like I'm mourning the work environment that once was. I hate change, especially change that doesn't feel like it's for the good. How do I get through it? I mean, this listener, I don't know if it's male or female, is talking like mourning, like loss. Mm. And when we were talking about repatriation on the show recently, that was an interesting aspect of if you are moving back to your home country or even onto another country, that you need to acknowledge a loss mm-hmm. of your life here, maybe of your relationship dynamic, of your routines. And this really reminded me of that mm-hmm. conversation, because, you know, we spend an awful lot of time in the workplace. We sit opposite mm-hmm. people. We, you know, we come to trust them and need them and make them often hopefully feel like we are our best selves in the workplace. What advice would you give to the listener who sounds like they're having a really unexpectedly to their mind tough time?
Well, I think it is loss. Absolutely. And we can become very close friends with our work friends. So while they're friends at work and they're not necessarily friends with our families, mm-hmm. we can become very close and very have a very close, trusting relationship with our work friends. And it completely changes the culture and the environment and the team dynamics and so much when that person's no longer there anymore. And I think that is a really important aspect of what sounds like this listener is going through. So 100% grieving, mourning, and it's not going to be the same.
No, it's not. It's interesting. It also reminded me of when people leave Dubai. I don't know if you've had this, when people go, right, we're going, and you start to think, oh gosh, well, maybe we should go. Do you know what I mean?
I want to go too.
And then I'm like, no, I don't want to go. But you start to feel insecure in your own decisions, because someone else is kind of forcing this change upon you, you know, directly or indirectly. Thank you for raising that. I think that's a really, really important one. I wanted to end, if you don't mind, on the concept of different until it is normal, especially when it comes to helping children understand and hopefully accept new situations. Can you explain it for a little? What's the top line of that concept?
Well, it was something that I thought of using to help my daughter when COVID happened. And she was 2.5, roughly at the time, going to nursery. And that September, she was starting big school. And of course, the nurseries didn't open. They closed in March. Everyone was thinking they're on holiday. Mm-hmm. And then they didn't reopen. And I was very, very worried about her starting big school in a new environment, completely different teaching staff, completely different environment. So I was thinking, what ways can I do to help a 2.5-year-old understand that it will become normal? So my whole idea was, what can I make as a really simple kind of dipstick to check in on her in a way that implies and tells her brain that one day it's going to be normal? So different until it's normal is something that I used to do every time I picked her up from school. And I would say to her, is it different or is it normal? Is it still different or is it normal yet? And every day, it's like telling her one day it's going to be normal without saying one day it's going to, because mm-hmm. even the phrase one day it's going to be normal is like, it's not happening now.
It's abstract. But it's hard for kids.
If someone says, is it different or is it normal yet? It's like, I'm expecting it to be normal. Is it normal yet? And that really, it was really interesting because it took a while. What enabled me to do was talk her through what was different and what was normal.
Mm-hmm. And kind of explore, you know, teacher subjects,
yes.
friends, so be uniform.
The teacher's different. Yeah. I have to wear uniform. And sometimes, and completely unpredictable in her mind, what was different and what was normal. I would never have been able to predict it.
I am totally stealing that. Because I think
fantastic.
I think whether it's a 2.5-year-old or, you know, you're an adult, we all have these times of adjustment and recalibration. And sometimes you're like, oh yeah, now it feels normal. And one day it will.
Mm.
And as you say, one day everything will be okay. Rania, for anyone that wants to avail of your time, your insights, you know, coaching, whether it's kids and you work with all sorts of different experiences and backgrounds as well, what's the best way of getting in touch with you?
Well, my email address is rania@ranyalaying.com. So in the first instance, really easy to remember. Happy to receive emails. Happy to just receive any other questions that we didn't have a chance to go through.
I was just about to say to anyone that we didn't get to today, I'll reply with your email address if that's okay. Or if
Absolutely.
You want to send me the word change, I will send you Rana's details. Thank you so much. So much
Thank
to think
you.
About. And as I said, I love the idea of exploring personality types in full and thinking about how they can inform our ability to make decisions, to respond to change and decision making. I've got a great book that I'm going to bring in for you to have a look at, because it's actually called something like How to Make Kick-Ass Decisions. And it talks about really how to, even things like driving home a different way or sleeping upside down can help our brains work in a completely different way. Rania, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Mudase, what was that? It is the concept of different until it is normal. Now, yesterday I posted a photo on my Instagram stories, which was me looking a little bit shell-shocked after a spin class. I hadn't been to the gym in about a month between 2 bouts of antibiotics and travel and Eid and work and weather and sick kids. And despite the fact that I've been to this gym, I think I'm closing in on my 100th class there. I was so nervous about getting into that lift. I even almost did a U-turn and just thought, ah, well, I'll just blame the roads and cancel it. The number of messages I had of going, thank you for saying this. Gym intimidation, gym anxiety is real. So I thought, maybe it's not just me, which is why we're talking about today. It is the anxiety that you might feel about going to or working out in a gym. According to research out of the UK, 2 in 5 adults avoided the gym because they felt too self-conscious. And Nikita Fulwani is with us today. She's an entrepreneur. She's a founder and managing director of By Niggy Marketing and Management and content creator. She recently shared a 90-day fitness journey, which amassed millions of views on Instagram. I always feel a bit cringe about saying the word journey, Niggy, but I feel like in your case, it's actually really relevant because you've accomplished and achieved so much, you know, personally, professionally, with that fitness. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your why. Why did you want to turn around your life, turn around your health? Can we start at the beginning?
Yeah, no, health has definitely been a journey for me and one that has been really rewarding. Thank you for that beautiful introduction, by the way.
Pleasure.
Yeah, I think for me, when it comes to my health journey, it started off in 2020, which was when I was actually a plus size content creator. I was 118.2 kilos. So that word that you mentioned, the gym anxiety, the gym intimidation, was extremely real. I think as a bigger person, who knows, yeah, I need to hit the gym to get healthy. In fact, it's so intimidating that I wouldn't even choose health and fitness as an option because you're always worried about, oh, someone's going to judge me. What if I don't know how to use a machine? What if I drop a dumbbell? And like people who are extremely fit, like just, I don't know, the gyms here are so big that when you walk in, you feel like really like tiny and like, and you know, through my journey, which has been over the last 4 years, where now I call myself a gym girl. I'm obsessed with the gym, but funny enough, till date, I can have moments where stepping into a new gym can make me feel like, oh, do I fit in here? Do you think I know how to like re-rack my weight? So gym intimidation is extremely real. But I've also had my realizations, you know, of it. But yeah, like...
Thank you for being so honest about that. Because as I said, for someone to look at your account now, you'd never think that you'd have any insecurities about being in that space. What I've found really frustrating over the years, and I've had, you know, kind of a similar experience and, you know, lost weight and kept it off and, you know, I guess it had to put myself in quite uncomfortable situations, you know, going into classes or training sessions, is that a lot of people in the fitness industry don't understand this because a lot of people that work in fitness who are PTs, who, you know, run gyms, have never felt like an outsider in a sporty environment. They were probably the sporty kids at school. You know, they're very confident and competent in their abilities to move and, you know, wear gym gear and be in that space. And I'm not blaming them. I just feel like it's a very specific mindset for someone to go, I know this is scary. And as you're saying, when you feel like you are the biggest, the weakest, the slowest, as I felt I was so often, that's a big thing to overcome. So how did you begin to do that, Niggy? Tell us a little bit about your ability to feel that discomfort and continue to put yourself in that space.
Yeah, I think I still remember my day one that I stepped into the gym or even when I went to, you know, meet someone for a consultation. I don't think I even looked up. I did not even have the courage to look up because when I walked out of that gym meeting, I remember just noticing everyone's calf muscles because I just did not even have the ability to look up at the gym floor and see all the fit people and envision the fact that, oh my God, do I have to show up here every day? I won't lie, the first time I always chose, you know, the tiniest corners or where I would be hidden, where nobody could see whether I'm squatting not low enough or is my lunge okay or am I picking up the lightest weight. So I would always find like the tiniest corners where nobody would even know that I exist or I'm doing something. And what I realized, and it just got more and more day after day, that everybody in the gym is actually too busy noticing themselves. You know, especially the fit people, they're so busy looking at their, like they're so busy doing their own fit checks. They don't even like notice. And then I kept telling myself,
I was just about to say, I've had a message on the text line saying exactly that. Cheney says, I recently joined a gym and have started going to classes for the first time. I'm the biggest person in every class, but no one stares. No one actually cares because they're busy getting on with the class. I take it at my own pace. I take breaks. The instructors sometimes do alternates for me, but not in a humiliating way. She said, thank you, ladies, for raising this. If you are feeling hesitant about going to the gym, have a walk through. This is your sign to get in the gym. If it's been on your mind, I promise you'll be fine. Chaney, thank you so much for sharing that. I feel like we need to start a little support group here. So you feel like other people are checking out their own form and they've got, it's a bit like the beach, isn't it? I always feel really self-conscious at the beach. Yeah. And I look around and go, no one else is exactly like, well, in some beaches they are absolutely banging. Most people are already feeling self-conscious about, you know, how they look themselves. So it's really, really interesting. I wanted to ask you a little bit about gym etiquette because the gym group in the UK has banned its members, this is really interesting, at 234 branches from posting photographs or videos taken on their premises on social media with people identifiable in the background without getting consent. Are you seeing that a lot in UA gyms? A lot of the gym posturing and the, you know, the tripod setup and don't get into my shot.
I mean, I do see a lot of gym content that's being shot here in the UAE. So I don't think those rules are trickling down anywhere here. But personally, for me, I actually make it a point that I take it from an angle where no one else is visible. Because a gym can be a place where people are extremely self-conscious. Not everybody wants to be on social media. Mm-hmm. So I actually make it a point that whatever I take, like whatever piece of content I take, I make sure no one else is in the frame. Because I don't know if they're comfortable or not, and fair enough. But at the same time, I know that taking those videos has actually inspired and impacted women who were similar to my size to know that, hey, listen, gym intimidation may exist, and, you know, it's okay to feel anxious, but exactly, you know, what the respondent said, it's more important to go after health, fitness. Absolutely. And these little anxieties and self-consciousness will probably exist, but it goes away. It goes away. It goes away sooner than you know it. So don't stop yourself from doing the right thing because of these things that you will get easy with. You will realize that, hey, it was just in your head and it's okay.
Coming your way off the traffic, keeping Nikita Fulvani with us because I'm curious about the importance of finding a good mentor, a good trainer, a supportive community when it comes to getting onto that health and fitness track. Also got some messages from you as well. So if you want to share your tales or advice when it comes to gym intimidation, the text lines are open on 4001. You can, be completely anonymous. And if you want Nikita's details, you can just send me the word fit. I will send you her Instagram so you can indeed check out everything that she has achieved and how she continues to inspire a lot of people, including me, every single day. Just a minute left now with Nikita Fulvani, entrepreneur, founder, managing director of By Niggity Marketing and content creator as well. She's been sharing her own fitness journey and we're talking about gym intimidation, feeling a bit anxious about stepping into the gym after a long time or maybe for the first time. I'm saying on 4001, hi both, this is real. I hate walking into a new gym or class for the first time. The only thing that helps me is a dark studio where you can't see each other. Why do you think I like spinning so much, Em? Last question to you, if you don't mind, Niggy, which is, I guess, the importance of finding a community, a mentor, a trainer to boost your confidence in these situations. You know, how has that benefited you personally?
Yeah, I think for me, it has, you know, been a big part of working with someone who understood bigger bodies and wasn't just judgmental. They weren't, you know, they knew how to literally transform someone. I lost 53 kgs, you know, through my journey, which doesn't come easy. And the best part is that I've done this with other people who've had massive weight losses as well, 15, 20, 30 kilos. So I think I have been, you know, I always had that community around me where we all understand our battles, we all understand our struggles. And I think one of the things which helped me build a community similar to this is because I started off at, you know, as a plus size person, and sharing my journey online brought people who were perhaps going through similar things or took inspiration from me, shared with me their insights. And it was almost like normalizing fitness or normalizing health, I would say, for someone who was living a completely different life. I think what I felt in some gyms when I walked in is, do you realize that this space is most needed for people who need to actually get on that healthy, you know, the healthy way of living life? Because, you know, being overweight comes with other, you know, health issues. So this place, the gym, should actually be normal.
Absolutely. Is it as inclusive as possible? Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I think a big part of it is going to a space that, you know, has got real representation. Another message here saying, I recently joined a gym and there's a huge range of ages, sizes, women in modest Muslim dress, such as your, plus your stereotypical gym user. You can't be it unless you see it. And I think that extends to in the gym, but also online as well. So I just want to say a final thank you to you for representing, showing up, inspiring, making us laugh as well. Really, really appreciate your time, Nikita. Thank you so, so much. Keep
thank
it up.
You.
I'll see you on Instagram.
Thank you.
Really tapped into something there. Gym anxiety. It is real, as Em says. Here's something I didn't think I'd say before. A rocket scientist is joining us live in the studio. Now, space technology is not just about exploring the cosmos. It's also about solving some earthbound challenges too. Dr. Ozan Kara specializes in using space technology for disaster management. So leveraging satellite imagery, communication systems, looking at some early warning systems, and we're going to be looking at how it is revolutionizing the space. Pun fully intended. Dr. Ozan, how are you?
Thank you, Helen. Thank you for the nice introduction. And
my
I'm
pleasure.
So excited to be here to try to emphasize how space technology used for our Earth, to protect our Earth.
I am so fascinated by what you do and, of course, the implications for us here on Earth. Tell us a little bit about your own journey, your own background from, you know, Istanbul to Abu Dhabi. You're at the Technology Innovation Institute Propulsion and Space Research Center. Tell us a little bit about why you wanted to work in this space.
Yeah, definitely. Like most of the childs as I am, like I inspired from the space, but the journey took me to the work in actual space field after university. So I did my all the academic careers until the PhD, and then we found a company in Istanbul supported by Defense Ministry. I worked in the actual rocket field. We sent too many rockets to the space.
So your own bits of kit, so projects you've worked on have been to Mars?
Yes, not the Mars, but actually the space border.
Wow.
However, some of my research fields that consist of the Mars rocket, so it's a conceptual, and I proved too many systems in engineering for the Mars.
Wow, good.
So hopefully in the future we can use for these components and the propulsion system for the Moon or the Mars.
What a job. Tell us a little bit about the work you do and the entities you work with kind of are supporting the UAE space workforce.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I'm really excited to be in the UAE. And when I first met with my colleagues from TII, Technology Innovation Institute, Propulsion and Space Research Center, they invited me to work in the field of creating rocket projects, as well as we have too many projects such as trajectory design, how we can go to the Moon, how we can go to the Mars by using efficient path and the fuel. Too many projects are going on in PSRC, and we are trying to contribute to UAE and inspire the young students to be involved in the actual systems. Personally, I design and develop the first hybrid rocket motor to be used in the space applications for the UAE.
Some of the most fascinating images to come out of this last week have been those NASA images, which is, you know, showing the flooding
definitely
that we've seen here in Dubai. Can I ask you, with your rocket scientist
definitely
hat on, you know, how do you reflect on the unstable weather that the UAE has experienced? You know, can you shed a bit of light on that?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, currently we have plenty of satellites taking live images from the Earth. Some of the satellites operated by agencies such as NASA, European Space Agency. Some of them are organized by commercial entities. So during the emergency event, they try to come up with the emergency response or post-processing of the images. So currently NASA, by using Landsat satellite and European Space Agency using Sentinel satellite, these two space agencies created the post-imaging of the flooding. So it shows the which areas are flooded. That means, and the next time you can take a precaution in these areas, mm-hmm. and you can also measure the level of flooding. You can also measure the atmospheric changes, how CO2 level changes, how methane level changes. And it means that you can create different aspects to prevent, at least prevent or precaution to the disaster. Maybe, yeah.
So you're able to identify those hotspots, the vulnerable parts.
Yeah, definitely.
Tell us a little bit, you know, you've had panels on disaster management using these space technologies. Yeah, what are some of the big takeaways? And if you could talk to me as if I'm a 10-year-old and yeah. I don't have a PhD in rocket science, that would be amazing.
I consider myself still 10 years old. So actually, so one of the fields I focus on the how we can use these images to support the natural disaster. Support means to prevent. So one of the actual projects I involved in, it was in Turkey earthquake, 2023, Turkey-Syria earthquake. Mm-hmm. So I was there, and then I created a panel in upcoming international space conferences that I invited the exact pioneers, people from the United Nations and NASA and so on. So briefly, so what we can do is we can create faster image processing by using the satellite and try to create and support the early warning systems. So that is a key. And it is like as we take the picture in our iPhone or any other smartphone, the satellites take the picture, send it to our computer in the Earth. We open the image. What we do is we use the AI algorithms to identify, okay, this structure is damaged. This is the shock effect in the ground and so on. That is exactly this simple process.
Wow, it's so much to think about. Yeah. It really, really is. Dr. Ozan Kara is with us today. We're going to be exploring this further. I'm curious about where this conversation is going to go in the next decade. How can space technology be utilised to create more early warning systems? And also our response to it too. Plus, how can we get the next generation involved in space and that space field? If you've got any questions for how about our resident rocket scientist? You can reach out on 4001. You can use the SMS, of course, there. You've got the app, you've got the WhatsApp. Dr. Ozan with us today, speaking to us. He is here in the UAE, the Technology Innovation Institute Propulsion and Space Research Centre. So what is happening with the UAE? What can we expect from the future? Joining us in studio to talk space technology and ultimately how we can leverage satellite imagery, communication systems and revolutionise disaster management, we have got Dr. Ozan Kara, Senior Researcher at Technology Innovation Institute. Although I really hope on your business card it just says Dr. Ozan, Rocket Scientist. I wanted to ask you to explain how space technology is going to be utilised specifically here in the UAE to help create early warning systems for natural disasters. What's happening now and where is it going to go?
Yeah, it's a great question. Actually, when I moved to UAE, I'm impressed that there are too many projects are going on. Actually, I can give quick examples, then it will be emerged too much. The first of all, UAE Space Agency is creating collaboration with commercial companies in all around the world. They created too much competitions, including artificial intelligence and satellite manufacturing. So second of all, I organize a workshop in COP28 and the participation about nationals, Emirates students and engineers and the other people in other backgrounds was amazing. It mm-hmm. means the awareness of the space technologies in UAE is boosting. So Space Agency, TAI or similar institutions supporting with the real projects and the job opportunities.
So exciting area right now.
Definitely, definitely. And by using these technologies, I think in upcoming years, we will wait for more excited projects.
What do you predict we'll be talking about in 10 years' time? You'll be like, oh yeah, of course we know how to, you know, prevent, predict. What, you know, if you could get your crystal ball out, Doctor, what do you think this the potential is for this?
The one of the most significant potential is the awareness. And the people who are 20 years old will be 30 years old and they will manage these projects and technologies. The second, though, is in more technical, which means if we create more AI-based systems that we all know, the ChatGPT, and the satellites will tell us, oh, be careful about the zone. Maybe next week it will be flooding, or maybe there will be forest fire and so on. We will get these early warning systems more alive, let's say.
And then that feeds out from, you know, government in terms of raising awareness among population. We look at different, you know, building techniques. We look at different, you know, what prevention methods that are on ground and ready to go. Really, really fascinating.
Yeah,
now, let's talk about the next generation, because you used to teach children in Istanbul in the Toy Museum.
Yes.
And you're preparing a workshop for the Cultural Foundation in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask, you know, how do you suggest that we encourage children, students who want to be a rocket scientist such as yourself, or, you know, want to work in the space field? What can us as parents be doing to encourage that interest?
Yeah, thank you so much, which is because we are here. That's because of the Inspire the Children, to try to share our insight, our experience, and try to guide them to find their path in the science and technology and the art and music. So basically, I can suggest to all people who wants to explore in the space field, be involved, to read more, to create more hands-on practices when we can teach our children to do how to make a plane or the rockets by using some tools, or sending to space camps maybe, and so on. What I am organizing in Cultural Foundation in Abu Dhabi, there is a initiative called Children's Museum, that a workshop series that we will do our 3D printed rockets or the Mars rovers and so on. So that kind of activities, I think, in UAE will emerge more. And I highly suggest to people, do the real things in the childhood.
The sky is the limit. Last question. Yeah. A quote that's actually in your email signature is Albert Einstein, who said, if I only had 1 hour to save the world, I'd spend 55 minutes defining the problem and 5 minutes finding the solution. How does that philosophy resonate with your approach in leveraging some of the space technology, you know, past, present and future, for disaster management specifically, Doctor?
It's a really good question, because this quote in my email more than 20 years that I like, because we try to hurry the things sometimes, or when we have the problem, we maybe skip the things to see. So that's why I personally suggest to understand the side aspects of the problems and try to come up with an imagination, the response with an imagination, because now we just Google it, we find it. I remember when I was in university, I had like 50 books, including different fields, try to imagine and try to come up with, you know, inspiration. Mm-hmm. So that's why this quote refers especially for the space technologies to prevent the natural disasters, that, okay, we have these spots, real spots now after flooding in Dubai. You can check the NASA website. Then, okay, we'll think how to prevent these flooding or similar natural disaster in the next time, then we will approach the solution.
So really be proactive.
Yeah.
And it sometimes these things, these solutions present themselves by accident. You go, that was not what it was intended for, but my goodness, what a wonderful benefit. Well, thank you so much. For anyone
that
wants to find out more about the work you have done and the work that's going on at Technology Innovation Institute, what's the best way of getting in touch, Dr. Ozan? Your Instagram, maybe?
Yes, definitely. I use the social media a lot. Instagram, Ozankara Space is my account. You can reach out to me. I can try to guide you in every aspect of the space technologies. And please check the TII, Technology Innovation Institute, to find different technologies, starting from AI to robotics to renewable energies and the space.
Thank you so much.
Thank
really
you, Helen.
Appreciate your time. Safe trip back to Abu Dhabi. Have you ever had the sense that you've done something or gone through a situation before? Does it seem like you know what's going to happen next? That feeling is often described as déjà vu. The saying comes from the French meaning already seen. Now, some people think that déjà vu is a sign of a kind of potential psychic phenomenon, but there could be other causes for your déjà vu experiences. Carolyn Yaffe is with us today, counsellor and cognitive behavioural therapist at Medcare Medical Centre. I love this topic, Carolyn, because it's something that I experience pretty frequently. How about you?
Yes, and I think it's just, it's a very cool feeling, actually.
It's so hard to explain. And sometimes you'll be in a situation and you might be at dinner or you might be around the table or walking somewhere and suddenly it'll strike you. And to my mind, I always feel like I'm kind of like walking in treacle a little bit as I just try and work out what's going on. So it is a really interesting phenomenon as such. But I wondered if we could kind of put our science hats on and try and get a bit of an understanding about the latest or the most reliable scientific explanations about déjà vu and maybe its causes as well. What do we know?
Okay, well, you know, first of all, just like you said, you know, the common thinking about déjà vu is that it could be some kind of psychic experience, such as remembering something you've experienced in a previous life or in a dream. And while keeping an open mind is never a bad thing, there's actually no scientific evidence to support any of these ideas. But where there is scientific evidence is that stress and exhaustion can certainly contribute to...
That adds up.
Yeah, I mean, being busy or tired, and especially if you haven't had enough sleep. Imagine if you can imagine what you feel like when you only sleep between like 1 and 3 hours.
I always kind of put it down to I have quite a rich inner life. I have really elaborate dreams. They've got secondary characters and subplots and, you know, like these epics. And I often feel like my dreams come true, like a conversation will happen or I'll be in a situation. And it's the dream thing that I find quite a lot. There are quite a few theories around it. Like there's memory theories, there's brain function theories. There's something called a hologram theory as well. I wondered why we think some people might experience déjà vu more than others, Carolyn?
Well, again, like I said, I mean, people who are exhausted or stressed out, they tend to experience déjà vu more. And this, again, is probably because fatigue and stress are connected. And that's likely, most likely, that's one of the causes.
Let us know on the text line if this resonates with you. We've had a message from Julie saying, with my first and second pregnancy, I had a recurring nightmare. I travelled to New York pregnant with my second child, and when I was in New York, the reality of my nightmare became apparent. I walked into a building and recognised it. I couldn't remember why, and then I remembered I'd seen it. My dream with my first child and the pregnancy of my second. Déjà vu.
Wow.
Interesting. So chuck some hormones in with the exhaustion. Your déjà vu chances are probably going to go through the roof.
And, you know, also, too, déjà vu occurs often when our perception or our memory aren't necessarily in sync. Mm-hmm. So basically, it's like what's familiar and what we're recalling sometimes are not asynchronous. They're not in
cohesive.
Sync. Exactly.
Interesting. So, right. Got more questions. Carolyn Yaffe's with us today from Medcare Medical Centre. We're talking about déjà vu. We've had a message asking, can it be something to do with your health? So we're going to explore that a little bit. You know, how do you know the difference between a normal déjà vu experience and associated psychological mental disorders? Get in touch. We'd love to hear if this is something that you have experienced. Or is it just me and my stress? 4001, you can be anonymous if you like. We've also got the app and the WhatsApp too. Can déjà vu be an indication of a health issue? We'll find out. Theories abound around déjà vu. Carolyn Yaffe with us today, counsellor and cognitive behavioural therapist at Medcare Medical Centre. We were just chatting off air about, you know, what's keeping you busy, Carolyn, and it was very much anxiety and panic attacks from teens all the way through up to adults. And deja vu, we can, you know, there are various theories, but one of which is if you do experience this, it can be a sign of stress and burnout, exhaustion, fatigue. But there can be, it can be an indication of psychological discomfort or even some health disorders. Are you able to speak to that? Anything that we need to know about what's happening in the brain that could, and we should be very careful. We're not saying that if you get deja vu, you know, have definitely got a certain situation going on. But what can it be, something worth investigating?
You know, just to state, I'm not a neurologist, but, you know, I did do research on this, and some of the neurological explanations of deja vu attribute the phenomenon to either a small temporal lobe seizure, but in a person without epilepsy. It doesn't have to be connected with epilepsy. And it sounds to me like that's a little bit of just like a little blip. Mm-hmm. Or a delay in transmission between the eyes and the ears or other perceptual organs and higher order processing centers in the brain.
Wow.
So, yeah. And also, too, it is said, and I did read this, that it can be attributed to the beginnings of dementia, but I was really kind of
cautious
on the fence
about saying that.
About admitting, discussing that, because again, I'm not a neurologist, I'm not a medical doctor. And also, too, I read that that is extremely, extremely rare.
It's all information. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that stress and burnout piece. As you said, it's the majority of people that are coming into your clinic at Medcare. Why do you think it is? What is stressing people out right now in the UAE? And I know we can obviously look to this past, you know, week, which is an extreme example of extreme stress for an awful lot of people. But when we kind of zoom out a little bit to maybe the last 6 months or year or couple of years, have you noticed any patterns? Because you've been here for, you know, over a decade now, Carolyn.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I think there's always like a paradigm shift every few years. And I think that increasingly things are getting faster. And I think it's really hard for people today to slow down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the most common things that I hear from people are what's going on at work, the pressures at work. People tell me stories that they're being contacted, you know, via WhatsApp at, you know, 10, 11, 12, 1 in the morning. And it just doesn't stop. And that just really creates anxiety. And with young people, I would say primarily high schoolers or secondary school, it's the amount of academic pressure that they're facing.
It's really interesting you say that, because on Iron Education this coming Thursday, we're talking about exam stress, but kind of wrapping around that with a psychologist talking about how as parents we can be encouraging and supportive without tipping into that pushy parent territory, because it's so, so damaging. It really, really is. To come back to the work thing, though, it's a tricky one because, and I'm guilty of this, you know, people ask me, how are you? I'm like, oh, I just said it to you before. I'm so busy. I'm so busy. And sometimes we kind of fetishize this idea of busyness because it means that, oh, you know, I'm in demand or I've got a lot going on and da, 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 da. It's not helpful. It's not a helpful thing to do.
It's not. And I mean, I'm guilty of it as well. And I think what, you know, what attributes to this is that we're connected to our phones. Mm-hmm. We always have our phones next to us, near us. And so, again, I mean, when people are WhatsApping you or emailing you, you're going to pick up the phone and you're going to look.
Mm-hmm. Turn off those notifications, folks. Yeah,
exactly.
You have to all just throw your phone in the sink.
Whether you're required to or not, it's just automatic.
What can be really hard, though, is putting boundaries in place when you've got into these habits with, you know, colleagues, with your boss, with partners, with friends, because that can be a shock to them. But touching on that idea around screen time and with teens in particular, please be with us tomorrow, by the way, guys, 2 o'clock. We've got Dr. Alison Burrows joining us as we're going to be talking about the impact of screen time on the developing brain. And it is not to be underestimated. It's not a case if you get to a teenager, you're a grown up, your brain stops developing at 25. And we know more and more about the neuroplasticity of a brain. So we might be 40, 50, 60, but we can still make changes to our brain. And I hate to say it, our beloved phones are maybe making changes for the negative. So tomorrow, 2 o'clock, if you want a bit of fuel in your fire, a bit of something in your toolkit about encouraging your teen or tween to put down their phone, you need to be there. Carolyn, in the meantime, where can people find you? You support adolescents, individuals, all the way through. What's the best way of contacting you?
To Medcare Kamali in Jumeirah.
Thank you.
That's where I'm located.
Really appreciate your time. And I kind of feel like I'm looking forward to having a bit of deja vu now. I kind of like the feeling. Message here saying, I think it's like a sixth sense. Sometimes I'm not stressed and I know what is happening next because I've seen it before. Hey, if it feels good, don't knock it.
Why not?
Why not? Carolyn Yaffe with us today, counsellor, cognitive behavioural therapist at Medcare.
This is Money Matters with National Bonds. Save, invest, prosper.
Wonderful to be joined on the line now by Hamza Zawali, the award-winning author of The 30-Day Job Search, serial entrepreneur, headhunter extraordinaire, as we talk about the art of negotiation, including, crucially, your salary, which I think is the one that a lot of people feel a bit of, well, a bit of discomfort about, to be honest, Hamza. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. How are you, Helen?
I'm really well, really, really well. I find this a fascinating topic because I feel like there's so many different things at play. I feel like there's cultural things, there's confidence piece that comes into play when we talk about negotiation. There's, dare I ask for more money? Shouldn't I just be grateful to have a job offer? So I wanted to start with by maybe asking, you laugh, it's true. In a tough market, people are like, yeah, I'll sign it. Yeah. That's fine. Yeah, you're going to pay me. Happy days. Tell us a little bit about your experience, your expertise, I guess, in the art of negotiation, because you've done this on both sides. You negotiate for people and obviously for yourself, and how it has played a crucial role in personal and professional settings as well.
Sure. So first of all, as you know, my background is into recruitment, so I've had to negotiate tons and tons and tons of times between, you know, in different sectors at different levels with different industries and different people all the time on behalf of people directly with me, between me and my firm. And then since I'm also an entrepreneur, I have different ventures. You know, negotiation, I think, is part of life. I would go to the extent, Helen, to say that everything is a negotiation. I negotiate with my wife and my daughter and sometimes my cat. I negotiate all the time. They never want to do what I would love them to do. And we have to find a compromise. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, yeah, it's... negotiation is everything all over the place. So salary negotiation is just one aspect, but negotiating different terms, not necessarily money, but a different agreement, mm-hmm. different sets of what you give me against what I give you, you know, is important. So
we're going to talk about salary in particular, but I guess I wanted to ask about negotiations in particular. You know, what are some of the common mistakes, the pitfalls that people make, and how can you avoid them for a favorable outcome? How do we need to shift our mindset about negotiating?
The number one mistake that people do is that they don't negotiate.
Just don't do
the
it.
Number
just
one
engage.
Mistake. That 100%. So it's one of these things where we social beings, aren't we? And we feel that if we show ourselves as ungrateful somehow, as demanding for more, asking for better terms, we would lose that social interaction. We would lose that potential, social connection that we made. And this is natural, absolutely natural. The correct thing is that it disappears, that dissipates as we do negotiation. The more negotiating we do, and the more fun it becomes, the more game it becomes. So that's the first mistake, is to not negotiate. The second biggest mistake is to it to be just expecting a result. To be result-driven. I want this, I need this, and I'm going to get this. That's a huge mistake. The number one tip about negotiating is really, truly understand what the other person wants. Really understand not just what they want, but why they want it. Why is it important for them? Because unless you empathize, unless you have two dialogues in your head, unless you have two sides in your head, you're never going to do justice. You're never going to connect to that person in a way that he's going to say, huh, okay, yeah, that I can accept. Because it would have done the you know, the effort of understanding what he or she wanted and why they really wanted. Why was that important to them? So these two mistakes are the most common, to be honest. Not negotiating and not caring about what the other person says or wants, mm-hmm. just trying to impose your own. And that's yeah, tricky. These are the two biggest mistakes.
I think confidence can be a big part, especially if you're starting out. You know, maybe you're looking to break into a new industry, you're starting out in your career, and maybe you don't feel like you're entitled to negotiate. You should be grateful. What are some of the key strategies, approaches, phrases to have in your toolkit, Hamza, to be able to, as you say, you know, you've done your research, you know what you're worth, you feel like, you know, you should be getting a higher number on that piece of paper. Where to start if that confidence piece is perhaps missing?
So because we don't, so in the case of salary, we don't negotiate salaries all the time. Not being confident about this is actually the norm. You'd be strange if you were super confident about negotiating the salary, since by definition, we don't do that very often mm-hmm. in our career. However, there is a phrase that allowed so many of my coaching clients to really get in the vibes of in the right mindset in terms of negotiating and get more confident. There is a phrase, whenever someone tells you, okay, the offer is this, you know, this is the package. The phrase that always worked is the following, is, listen, first of all, thank you. I really appreciate, and I'm honored actually to have been selected for this role, especially for a prestigious company like yours. Having said that, based on the numbers you just communicated, I just don't feel it, you know, it matches the value, or it aligns with the value I'm going to bring to the role.
So and you zip, so you say nothing so else. So you're immediately saying, you know, where can we go from here? But what you're saying is, I am worth more than that. It's not like I'm demanding more than that. It is, I am worth more than that. And
it's beyond that, actually.
It's beyond that. Go on.
It's beyond that, because what you're saying is the value I can bring to the role, you're going to get more from me than what you are actually. So the package, we have to understand that in terms of salary, the package that you have is the value or the perceived value that the employer has of your expertise, of your services. And if you start saying, well, you know, I'm the market is saying this, or I'm worth more than that, or yeah, that's your subjective opinion, and it doesn't necessarily hold much ground into the negotiation. However, if you say, well, look, I'm going to bring much more than the value you are reflecting on me. I'm going to bring much more to the table than what you feel, based on this number, I'm going to bring. And suddenly I make you think, because I'm thinking, huh, really? Okay, am I missing something here? Does it make sense?
It does. We've got questions asking about, how do you deal with pushback? If it's not salary, can you negotiate on other benefits? And even a message here, no name on this one for reasons that will become obvious. Starting a role next month, I've negotiated my salary, but now they've added a whole extra element to the job. Can I renegotiate before I start? Sounds like goalposts are being moved. Hamza Zawali is with us today. He is in recruitment, serial entrepreneur, and the author of the award-winning book, The 30-Day Job Search. It is on Amazon now.
This is Money Matters with National Bonds. Save, invest, prosper.
Joining us, we have got author, we've got entrepreneur, we've got recruit headhunter, Hamza Zawali. And we're talking about how to negotiate during salary negotiations. You've got the job offer, but how do you make sure the numbers add up? We want to go to the text line because I think this actually sums up a few messages we've had. D saying, I started a new role next month. When I was appointed, I negotiated my salary. Didn't have any line management responsibilities at that time, but they've now asked if I will manage a team of three. I'm new to being senior enough to negotiate my salary, so I don't know what good practice is. If I say yes, it adds a whole layer of responsibilities I didn't bargain for, although it's good for me because I will grow. But I wondered, is it possible to review after probation, or is it seen as really cheeky to negotiate before you've even started the job? When you've got a couple of minutes, Hamza, can you give us a quick answer for D on what's, is that cheeky to say, move the goalposts, so we're going to move that number?
So this is actually a really, really good opportunity, and she guessed it. So I think it is not cheeky to say, oh, this is a little bit different in terms of expectation, in terms of amount of work. I'm now going to have to, add much more value. Would you be open, since you changed the job description, would you be open to also align the package for this role?
I think
just ask a question.
I think that's totally fair. I think that's totally fair. And I think you'd kick
yourself. Just ask a question. If they say, no, not now, then your next move is going to be, okay, so providing that I do a good job, can we sit again in 3 months and review, the package in line with the achievements that I'm going to do? Mm-hmm. If they say yes, which is sometime in the future, there's very little risk. They only get to increase if you do a good job. Then it's very, very important to say, what do you expect on the first 3 months? Mm-hmm. So that they don't change the goalposts again. And get the email.
We've had a question here, which is saying, when do you walk away from negotiations when it comes to salary? When do you simply say, it's not working, even if you desperately need a job?
So I don't think, so let me be careful about this. I don't think you should ever go away in a negotiation. I think you should leave it to them to decide that. So I would always say that sentence, I don't think it reflects the value I can bring to this role. I don't think XYZ package reflects the value I can bring to this role. Yeah, I just don't think it's commensurate with the amount of, especially based on the value I can bring, this my experience in this industry, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I don't think that you should ever say, listen, that's a no. You should just say, I don't think it reflects the value. You can send me all job offer document you want. I'm not going to move because the conversation is still ongoing. Unless they say, take it or leave it. I don't think you should leave it unless they say that's my last shot. Because there's always a chance they say, okay, we can't offer you X, but can you accept maybe this, or can we sit down again in 3 months, or mm-hmm. or things like that. But I don't think you should initiate leaving the negotiation, because this is very hard to come back afterwards. It's funny you say that. Actually, I interviewed someone yesterday, and based on her experience, I said, whoa, that's really, I mean, the rest of my staff is paid, at the same level, but with absolutely amazing experience. I can't possibly do that. And she literally just said, okay, well, thank you so much for your time, and left. And I was like, oh, what a shame. I would have negotiated, So I don't think you should leave a conversation until they say it's take it or leave it.
Fair enough. Last question. Who holds the power right now? Is it the job seeker, or is it the potential employer?
Depends on your sector. It really depends on your sector. And so if you're an AI developer, you hold the power, you get paid a lot of money because you're very rare. Same with a lot of sectors around information security and et cetera. But if you're, let me give you an example that's easy. If you're a business developer and your track record says that you've made a lot of money for your previous employer, you hold the negotiation power. If you're a business developer and you're average, it's not, the power is not with you. So it really depends on the level of the person and the sector.
Well said indeed. We've had loads of people asking for your details, Hamza. So with your permission, I will share the link for the Amazon. Is that okay? So people can get to grips with what we've been talking about and more. Hamza Zawali,
absolutely.
Thank you so, so much. Author, entrepreneur, headhunter, as we've been talking about, his book is available now. Whenever I say, talk about coaching, he's like, read the book first and then contact me. So he's doing himself out of a few dirhams, but certainly saving you a few, but it's an absolutely fantastic read. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5pm.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.